I thought before we started going over the cases that struck you that there were two questions that occurred to me reading through this stuff that I thought I would mention. And one of them is that I think I have an idea for a new thread chapter. And that's the issue of rule of law versus rule of men. That we like to think that we have a system of rule of law. If you think about the Chinese system, it looks like it's a much more extreme attempt to get a rule of law. That is, you have a system of statutes which describe offenses in great detail and say, well, for this offense, here is the punishment. So it's an interesting question. First, the general question, you know, what are the advantages, disadvantages, why can you or can't you, should you or shouldn't you do it? But also this particular example of the ways, and one of the things you might think about with regard to your cases, are the ways in which the system is more flexible than it appears. That is to say, you have a system where sort of on paper it's a system that precisely maps every offense to a punishment. We tried to do it too, if you think about the Sentencing Commission, if you're familiar with it. In the U.S., you had a situation where there was a lot of public sentiment, whether it justified, I don't know, that judges were letting criminals off too lightly. And so there's the Sentencing Commission that sets up a list of mandatory sentences for various things. So, anyway, so in the Chinese case, did you know, I was thinking I may actually do another thread chapter on this and see if I can squeeze it in at some point and think about the ways in which different legal systems do or don't constrain the punishment for an offense. But did you notice in the cases you read ways in which the court was able to decide for itself what the punishment was, as it were, irrespective of the law? Examples? What examples occurred to you? Blows of the heavy bamboo.
And they reduced it to... Oh, I remember. It's in the case where there's someone who's an engaged couple, and if they have sex before they're married...
Why is that wrong, by the way? From the standpoint of Chinese law, what's wrong with having sex before you're married?
It's kind of like they were disobeying their parents.
That's right, of course. They're not doing what their parents told them to. Yeah.
But if they were, so they're engaged and they're independent people who are going about their business and engaged and living in their separate family houses, the man, not the woman, would get lashed 100 lashes.
Beaten. The only people who are being lashed in this, I think, are Manchus. If I've got it right, the Manchus, maybe the other banners, I'm not sure, have the privilege of having being beaten by a bamboo converted into an equal number of blows of a whip. But everybody else is being beaten. I should have gotten some bamboos and brought them in. And one year I found bamboos in a garden place or something of the diameter. There's a description of how big the ones were you're supposed to beat people with. But there's a light bamboo and a heavy bamboo. And I think the largest one, I think the diameter is less than 2 inches. It's an inch and 2 inches somewhere. And that's what they're being beaten with. And I have no very clear idea, never having had it done to me, just how... And one interesting question, given how many of the punishments are in that form, is this something that actually risks killing you or crippling you, or is it just painful for an hour or something?
100 strikes by the heavy bamboo during the main time, is very frequently a death penalty.
Yes, 100 is really only 40, if I remember correctly.
Well, during the main, it was really only 100.
Yes.
Yes. But under the Ming, officials that were punished, and there were several cases of prominent officials who got punished by 100 blows or 90 blows, they died their injuries in several ways.
Huh, that's interesting.
That's not unusual. But on the other hand, when you're whacking or when you're beating frail old men who have essentially the lives of academia, essentially, my parents, surprising that they have stand punishments, whereas if you beat somebody who's been working in the salt mines for years, it might be able to shrug that off.
Well, I was going to finish that.
Right.
So they would get 100, but then it was reduced by the court to 90 in the case where the female was living in the house of the male.
Yes.
Because she was more like a servant or a slave, and so the
or family member even. That is, in general, offenses against junior family members are less important than offenses against senior family members or against unrelated people. Yeah. Now, the business of living, I remember, not in the, from this book, but reading a discussion of the question of what sets off the incest, I don't really want to call it, sort of intuition in human beings. What makes you not think of your sibling as a possible sex object? And the assertion is that in Chinese couples where the bride-to-be was basically adopted into the groom's family, which is quite a common pattern, they had fewer children. And that that was taken as some evidence that it was growing up with somebody rather than some genetic link that triggered the not being very sexually interested in them, which I thought was sort of an intriguing way of mining this society for a bit of data. Whether the conclusion is right, I don't know, but I just remember that. It's sort of interesting. Other examples, yo?
Along the same lines, they studied the marital patterns of people living in kibbutzim, where in fact the children were raised together in a common creche. Intermarriage rates between those children were extremely low.
Huh, that's interesting, yeah. Back to the question, though, of flexibility. What are the ways in which in the cases you looked at, in which the court got a rule not actually determined by statute? Yeah?
I got one that was essentially parted afterwards. There was a tiger that escaped from the Imperial Park and killed a random man.
Yeah.
They eventually found the most stringent way of punishing him, which was deportation.
And they were punishing him there under a statute which was supposed to apply to what? Do you remember?
I think it was accidental homicide of either a man by an animal or an animal by a man.
Yeah, I should be able to find this.
Yeah. They weren't using the exact statute. They were using the similar one. And essentially, the guy later got...
The emperor decided that the punishment was too severe. So one way, but one which is probably very uncommon, is that the emperor can step in and change things. But the other thing which you're referring to, which is much more common, is that because you don't really have an exact mapping of fences, it looks as though there's a lot of discretion in deciding which statute you think this is close to. And in many of the cases, I think if you look at them, what's happening is that the court is saying, well, we could compare it to this, but that would give too light or too heavy a sentence, so we're going to compare it to that instead. So that's at least one respect in which you have a flexibility that sort of doesn't exist on paper, but exists on the ground. The other thing I was going to say before we go into more cases that I wanted you to look at is the ways in which the legal system interacts with other authority structures, in particular the extended family, because there's a lot of stuff where the legal outcome depends on the relationship among people. And there's a little bit of references to sort of guild structures into as well. Yeah.
I had a case on that point, and it was two men conspired to kill, then there was like three men that lived together in a cave. And they were kind of discussing whether they were considered a household as a unit. And they said no, because they all had separate occupations.
Why did it matter?
Why did it matter? Because I think it just, if I remember correctly, it was like punishment was different for killing. If you killed two people of the same household, you had a different
That puts it mildly, yes. I believe it is the case, though I have to check, that killing three members of the same household results in your being immediately tortured to death.
Yeah, I think it was different in time frame, though. I think the other one was that one person was premeditated murder, and the other person was, they had intended to kill him, but it wasn't premeditated, so there was a differentiation between the two of those. They weren't willing to try these two crimes together.
Yeah, that was one issue was whether or not you think of it as two killings or one killing of two people. But the other issue is the one you were raising before. Are they one family? And the doctrine seems to be that the family is not defined by blood relationship. Because, for example, it's pretty clear that slaves count as part of the family. That the family are people who share living space and property, more or less. Does anybody remember, a couple of you must have read, there's another case which goes the other way, but which hinges on the question of whether two people who are not closely related are members of the same family. Anybody remember that? Two men are traveling, they're I think on some kind of a trading trip, they're cousins, and they're sharing a room and I think sharing trading goods or something. And if I remember that story correctly, someone's steals from them, or they catch someone stealing them. I think the guy they've hired as the bearer to carry their stuff. And so they tie him up in the room they're in and go to sleep. And he manages to, I guess, not get free, but to poison their food. They've got like a bowl of leftovers from that dinner, I don't remember the details, and he's got some medicine for some ointment for his sores, which he puts into their food, and presumably it's arsenic or something similar, and they die. And the question is he guilty of the more serious crime of killing two members of one family, or merely of killing two people, which affects the punishment? And the conclusion is it's two members of one family, on the grounds that even though they're not closely related, and even though they normally don't live together, they were sharing rooms as they traveled, they had their goods together, and therefore that was close enough. And but again, one suspicion is that if, for whatever reason, the court had felt more sympathetic to the criminal, it might have interpreted it the other way. That is, it looked as though there were noticeable numbers of judgment calls on that sort of thing. But it's also sort of interesting that, because there's another case, if I remember correctly, where the defendant has behaved in a way that most of us would regard as entirely unobjectionable. That is to say, he and his father are attacked by some people. I'm not sure if there's another one with them. And in the course of the fight, one of the attackers kills his father, and he then kills the attacker. And he, if I remember correctly, is found guilty of a serious crime because he has killed, I think, two members of the same family, if I remember correctly. I'd have to look. One of them being the guy who just killed his father, which you would think on their principles is grounds for practically anything. So there's this interesting kind of balance, if you look at these, between sort of a strict liability for killing attitude and allowing various sorts of defense. So, for example, I don't know if any of you came across cases. What happens if somebody breaks into my house and is trying to steal stuff and I kill him? What's my legal situation? Yeah?
I think if you kill them immediately, then you're fine.
I'm home free.
If you wait and you think about it, then you're...
In particular, I think the answer is that if he's running away and I pursue him and kill him, I've committed a crime. And if I have if basically surrendered and I kill him, I've committed a serious crime. Whereas if I kill him in the process of sort of in the heat of rage when defending my property or stopping him from raping my cousin or things of that sort, that then I'm all right, which I thought was all sort of intriguing. How different is that from our law? Yeah?
Well, there was one case that I read about that too, which was about...
Yeah.
And it made a difference of whether the stealing was really stealing or not, or whether it was sort of just taking a little further.
Yeah.
I thought it was very odd.
Yeah. Well, there are various references suggesting that gleaning in someone else's field is legal. That if they've been picking the soybeans and you pick up a pod of soybeans that they've missed, so to speak, that's legal. Although there are disputes over that. People object to you doing that. And you could see that there could be a fine line between that and you're harvesting their crop.
The retaliation on the part of the person wrong, the owner of the orchard, death. I mean, they killed the person.
Yeah.
Stealing a fruit from their orchard,
yeah.
Which the court excused if the theft was...
But did he kill him in the... Did he deliberately kill him, or did he kill him in the process of trying to stop him?
I think it was considered a heat of the moment, so it was considered in that case, but I mean, that's not really... It's not like someone breaks into your house.
Yes.
Your livelihood is at stake. It's someone...
Well, but that one doesn't know in a poor society whether maybe if people consistently steal your fruit, maybe you starve to death. I don't know. And in any case, the question is whether the statute distinguishes. And there are a fair number of cases where the fact that one is forced to do something by poverty is seen as at least ameliorating, if not excusing it. Did people pay attention to the wife selling cases? There are a bunch of wife-selling cases where somebody sells his wife as a concubine, which is illegal, of course. And, you know, either the buyer knows it, but they're both concealing the fact, or the wife purports to be a widow, and you know, there's one case I think where they fake the report of death of the husband, and various things happen then. Anybody remember what the outcome either is supposed to be or is? We have three people, the husband, the wife, and the buyer, and assume the normal case where all three know what's going on. What happens? Yeah?
This is the case I have, which was according to it, all three are to be given. The people to be punished with 100 blows were the person who faked his own death, his wife, and who's the other person? Okay, and the guy, and the man who they married, and the man who the wife married. So all three of them were punished.
Were or were supposed to be? What was the what's the final outcome in terms of who was married to whom?
It's 223.4.
Because there's more than one such case, and I believe what the statute says is that the wife goes back to her family, and the money paid for her forfeits to the state, and. And the woman ends up with the second husband. So that's one of the cases where you've got a clear statutory formula, and yet the court manages to ignore it. Other? There was another fairly striking one, which was interesting in part going back to this question of to what degree the court is constrained by the law. Somebody must have covered the case near the end, which is, I'm not sure it was even a case, but it's a statement by the emperor about how people are misusing one of the statutes by leaving out part of it. Anybody remember that one? It's quite interesting. There's a statute which is about people who basically appeal to higher authority because they think the lower authorities acted unjustly. And the statute contains some very specific language about either stopping the emperor's chariot or beating the drum at the palace, which is asking sort of for the emperor's attention. And apparently, at least according to this, what courts were doing was leaving out those requirements and simply punishing people who had basically complained that the court's decision was unjust. And if I understand what's going on, the beauty of this is that the punishment that was being applied was only a beating with bamboo, which meant that the case didn't have to be approved by higher authority. So if you think about it, you're a district magistrate. You want to be free to make the decisions that you want to make without higher authority stepping on you. So what do? You make it clear that if people appeal your decision, you will find them guilty of this offense. You will beat them. Higher authorities will never hear about your beating them because they just go in the list of number of people you've beaten. You don't have to describe the case for them. And eventually, somehow, this gets the attention of the higher authorities, and there's this very strongly worded statement saying they're not to do that. That's cheating. That's a way of allowing sort of lower-level corruption. If the statute is used, it's only to be used in the specific, rather unlikely way in which it was originally stated. Now, that was really quite interesting. And it also plugs into the pattern you see in a number of societies that traditionally the ruler is sort of open to everybody to make complaints. That was, I think, theoretically, I think maybe in the footnotes to Richard Burton's translation of The Thousand Nights and a Night, which is a fascinating volume by a weird and interesting 19th century. As you may know, the modern actor Richard Burton is named after a 19th century English adventurer, linguist, author, translator, all sorts of weird and exciting things. Colorful character. Anyway, I think Burton comments that sort of, talking really about Muslim history, that others as well maybe, that dynasties start losing their power when they close that gate, because now whoever is the gatekeeper becomes the real authority. And there's some discussion, actually another one of the administrative ones, about the fact that the lower level clerks are approving or disapproving petitions, and this is giving them a power that ought to be exercised by the higher. I'm not sure if it's that you can't submit if they disapprove, or that they're strongly warning you it's not going to get approved, so you go away. Yeah.
I don't really understand the thread that you started.
Yep.
So you're saying the rule of law versus the rule of
To what extent is what happens to you when you commit an offense predetermined by the existing rules? And to what extent is it a matter of judgment by the people who are applying those rules?
Okay, so the judicial versus the legislative role in the punishment?
Well, it wouldn't have to, that is, I suppose. I'm not thinking about whether the laws are made by the judge. It's not, I'm not thinking about sort of precedent versus statute, but rather, simplest way of putting it, if I have a description of what you've done, and I know nothing about the court, can I predict what will happen to you? And at one extreme, you could imagine a legal system. Let's take the Athenian one, which is a very different kind of framework. But there are lots of offenses for which there is no stated penalty. And so what happens? You're convicted. Now the prosecutor proposes a penalty, the defendant proposes a penalty, and the jury votes between them. So that's one which, in that sense, the penalty part of it is not punishment by law at all. It's punishment by the act of a set of humans. And on the other hand, if you look at the way the Chinese system is at least nominally set up, now it's open and shut. You know, what did you do? You did, that's what back to the statute says, zip, you know, 80 blows of the heavy bamboo or whatever.
Isn't that sort of what precedent? Judge will typically, if there isn't a statute that describes the punishment, they'll look to previous cases where that similar crime was committed and transfer that punishment.
But at least in the Chinese case, they could presumably choose which previous case to look at. It's not as if you have a formal system of precedent with a Supreme Court the way we do, where there is in some sense well-established common law. This isn't really a common law system. And it's true they often say, well, here was another case sort of like this, so we can use that to figure out what we ought to do. But suppose you're the judge and the person is obviously guilty and you don't want to punish him. What do you do? What can you often do in the Chinese case? Nobody? None of you had cases where somebody ends up, after being convicted of something serious, being let off? What are they let off with? What's the normal method? No, exile is a punishment. Exile is quite a serious punishment, one of the higher level punishments. No, they're let off with monetary commutation. They're told, instead of being beaten with 80 blows and set off to 3 years of penal exile, you can pay 5 ounces of silver. All right, I haven't checked, but my memory is that Wergeld in Iceland was 200 ounces for killing. It might have been 400 ounces. The money pay punishment for killing somebody in China is about 5 ounces. And that's one of the high ones. Most of them are much less than that. So if you look at what's going on in those cases, I think there are some cases in which you don't have the option that I'd have to go through in more detail to figure out which ones you are or not. But there is some sizable subset of cases for which the court can but need not allow you to make a money payment in lieu of your punishment. And those money payments are typically trivially small relative to the scale of the punishment. So that looks, as far as I can tell, like a almost. I'm pretty sure, for example, that the commutation punishment for killing somebody, if you're allowed to commute it, which may depend on the nature of the killing, is about half as big as the amount that you have to pay for the funeral expenses of somebody you've killed in those cases where you have to pay the funeral expenses. I think that was about 10 ounces of silver, if I remember. So that's one way. What's the other way? All right, there's at least one other get out of jail free card, although not everybody has a possibility. What's the other way in which you can essentially eliminate most large part of the penalty? That's right. That if you are the only support of your parents, or if your parents are dead and you're the only person available to do the appropriate religious ceremonies to their ghosts, the court may but need not cancel sentences which are something like 3 years exile to distance of 2,000 li, Well, if the sentence is exile and you get to stay home, they just cancel the sentence. Now, you may still have gotten the beating. You may still have to wear the cane for some length of time. This is going to vary in the particular cases. But what looks to be the largest part of the penalty in most of these, which is some... Now, that's the other thing which is sort of curious, because not all of the exile involves penal slavery. And it seems to be taken for granted that being exiled to far from your home is a really serious punishment. You know, that's what they commute execution into, that kind of thing. And maybe the answer is that in that culture it really was a very serious punishment. I just don't know. You know, can you just start over again? Or is it because you don't have a family, you don't have connections, you're really going to be the lowest of the low in your new location? I don't think we know. I don't know. Maybe. Yes. From the same place. Yeah. Right.
All the 2,000 Lee exiles of the city.
But if I remember correctly, I think it also said that in some of the periods, the people who were supposed to have X years of labor were not actually being used as laborers. I think there are times when they're being used for either refining iron or purifying salt, those being, I think, two government monopolies, if I remember correctly. But there were other times when they basically just sent them and they took care of themselves, kind of thing. So again, it's sort of hard for... I mean, it's true for both the bambooing and the exile things, that it's hard as an outsider to guess just how serious which punishments are. What's the other respect in which it's not really fixed? How about all of the non-capital capital punishments? All right, are people paying attention to the difference between strangling before the assizes and strangling after the assizes? What does strangling before the assizes mean? It means you get executed, right? What does strangling after the assizes mean? Sounds like a very small difference, right? It means that almost certainly you're going to end up with one of the exile type punishments instead. That the after the assizes, you get sorted into one of several categories. The worst category, they apparently at random choose a selection to execute. The rest go back to jail. A year later, repeat. And after you've gotten through, I think, two of those for most crimes, and I think eight of them, if I remember correctly, for some serious crimes, you then get pushed down to the next level of punishment. If you're not in the worst, if you're not in those deserving of execution, now it is quite likely that when your case comes up, they will say, all right, push it one level down, give him, you know, 3 years, I don't remember which one it is, you know, 3 years exile to a malarial region, or 3 years exile to 3,000 Li, I don't remember all of the details of those, but to one of the things which doesn't actually involve killing you. So that's quite a sizable difference. And since, as far as I can tell, the statute doesn't say whether when you condemn somebody to be strangled after the assizes, it's with or without a recommendation of compassion, whether which category you want it put into, that would then be, I think, an area of pure judicial discretion. All right. Other things that struck people along these lines? Yes. Doing that which should not be done, I don't think includes exile. I think that, if I remember correctly, there are only two punishments for that. There's a lighter one, which is, I think, 40 blows of the light bamboo, and a heavier one that is, I think, 80 blows of the heavier bamboo. I don't think, though I may be wrong, that exile is covered in that. Yeah, there are two sort of blank check statutes, not in terms of punishment, but in terms of what they're for, or categories. One of them is doing that which should not be done, which has two levels of punishment. And the other is violating an imperial decree, which does not require that there actually be an imperial decree that you will violate. so that they both, I think there's a suggestion in the book that one of them was normally used for penal and one for administrative offenses, but both of them are things where either if someone has done something there's no law against, or alternatively, if someone has done something, but the closest legal rule that you would think of gives the wrong, from the judge's standpoint, the wrong punishment, you instead sentence them under one of these.
Actually, the law that this guy was punished on was submitting memorials to the throne which are deceptive and divergent of truth.
Yes.
That punishment was 100 blows and 3 years of penal service.
Yes, that sounds right. Yeah.
Should not be done.
Yes. Right.
The weird thing is that you're supposed to be submitting memorials to the throne if you're part of the administration. And the whole point about submitting memorials to the throne are, here are suggestions for change. So it's not the case that there is a problem with submitting memorials to the throne, is that you're submitting memorials that we have already rejected and you're annoying us now.
Uh-huh.
And this is the case here. He's actually done it on several occasions. They kept saying, don't do this anymore. And he still keeps doing it.
Because I thought there was another one like that where all they ended up doing was sending him back to his home city.
Same guy, but this is the third.
Aha, so it's the earlier they sent him back to. Right. So, yes. Right.
That is the whole purpose of submitting memorials to the throne. Is you're submitting memorials because you're making suggestions and changes.
Mm-hmm. Go.
So I kind of felt these cases are all over the place in terms of, there's no real, it didn't look like they were handling one area and another. It was just, maybe it was the time, maybe it was just during the course of the cases.
That's what you mean. It's the organization of the book, it is indeed by categories, by legal categories. It's just that their idea of legal categories is always the same as ours would be.
Okay. But would the same court hear all of these different...
I think almost all of these are a fairly high-level appeals court.
Okay.
From our standpoint. Appeals is the wrong way of putting it, because appeals are automatic. But what I believe is going on, if I've got it right, it's discussed in the earlier section of the book, is that except for the lowest level cases, for the case that we just bamboozled, all cases below the... the local court or one level above court gives you a verdict. That is then sent for approval to a higher level court, which presumably usually but not always approves it. And it's that higher level court, I believe, whose cases we're reading.
So capital punishment required the approval of the higher
capital level. Punishment takes it all the way up. In theory, the emperor has to approve capital punishment. I think anything more than bambooing pushes it up at least one level. The book, there's a discussion in the book, it goes into details, and it's complicated enough, so I don't remember exactly. But basically, none of these, I think, are called court of first impression, although they are sometimes describing what happened in the court of first impression. And they are normally saying, the level below us gave the following verdict, yes, that's right, we confirm it, or no, it's wrong for the following reason, or no, it's wrong, they really messed up, and we should be investigating them, which is rarer.
Now it's just a check and balance to make sure that the lower judiciary...
One way of looking at it, certainly, is that, again, it's a way of preventing... You could claim that it's a way of preventing the lower-level people from ruling according to their own beliefs rather than the law. Except that it's really not rather than the law, but rather than the beliefs of the higher-level authorities, since they are always conform to the law as well. One way, one of the issues that I've thought about a little bit in the Chinese context and in the other contexts is how you prevent a system like this from going feudal. Not feudal. You think about the kind of system. My working definition of a feudal system, which is my own, is a system where the critical resource is controlled at a low enough level so the people at the top are coalition leaders rather than rulers. So I would have said that in medieval Europe, the critical resource was heavy cavalry, knights, the equivalent. And it was the barons, not the king alone, in effect. So the figure I remember seeing was sort of striking at one point for France at some early date was that the levy of Normandy was larger than the levy of France. Right? The Duke of Normandy is an allegiance to the King of France. If the King of France had a call for an army, the Duke of Normandy has got to give him a certain number of knights. But he doesn't have to give him all the knights, he just has to give him the number of wives he gives. Under the Duke of Normandy, there are a bunch of other people who are obliged to give the Duke of Normandy knights. He calls for a levy,
sum is larger not only than owed to the, than the Normandy owed to France, but than everybody owes to France. So that would be sort of difficult to do. When I read Plunkett and Family Hall, which is a delightful book if you would like to know about city machine politics in America. All right, Plunkett was a... people know what Tammany Hall was? Great American institution. It was the big city machine that ran New York for a century. I mean, I think the longest lived of the American big city machines, Democratic machines. And Plunkett was not quite at the top of Tammany Hall, but a high up Tammany Hall person. He ends up as a state legislator and various other things. And back when he sort of semi-retired, a New York newspaper ran your And we will never know for sure how much of the resulting book is by the newspaper man and how much by Plunkett, but I believe it's Plunkett. It was quite a distinctive, interesting, somewhat cynical, very entertaining defense of the big city machine system. And as he described it, the way you get power in Tammany is by being able to deliver votes. That what you do is to make sure that people in your neighborhood know you and will vote the way you say. And the competitions for power in Tammany involve alternative district leaders who are doing things, who are making sure that when somebody prominent in the community dies, they provide more carriages for the funeral procession than their competitor does in order that they'll be in a position to deliver them. It's quite charming. But my impression is there's a real sense in which that was a feudal system, which you could easily enough imagine whoever the current Tammany boss is, if he slips up, a coalition of people below him are going to replace him with some other thing. Yeah, you were... No. Anyway, it's a little book, and I just think it's everybody ought to read it. Yep.
My grandfather actually was in New York in the latter days of Tammany Hall. He would occasionally praise its operation and say that was really how city government functioned, and it was destroyed by Roosevelt's changes to the American governmental system. I never understood his critique, but I've never really.
Well, read Plunkett, because Plunkett, he clearly is in favor of the system, and he sees it really as a system in which, in practice, the local people have to do a good job of taking care of the people in the neighborhood and doing things for them in order that those people will vote the way they say, in order that they'll have political power in Tammany. He had a wonderful discussion, by the way, of how to the way in which a young man can profit from the system, and it's by being a reformer. That basically, he runs through the cost of being a reformer, you know, getting newspaper articles about how you're going to reform Tammany Hall and throw out the corrupt SOBs and so forth. And you need, I think you have a union office for a little while. It doesn't cost very much. And then you sell out to Tammany for a permanent position, you know, as a judge or something. And he does the accounts that show how much money you're getting for a relatively trivial investment in being a reformer. It's also the book where he defines honest graft. He comments that he heard how in Philadelphia, where they've got a Republican machine, corrupt bunch of people, somebody stole the tin roof off an orphanage and then buckled it up and sold it. So that would never happen in Tammany, where we're good Irish Democrats, much more honest than that. But he says it might be that there was somebody in Tammany who was in charge of that orphanage, and it might be he would decide they needed a new roof, and it might be he'd hire somebody to put a new roof on the orphanage. And once they put the new roof on, they don't need the old roof, so it might be he would then have the tenant to sell. And it might be he'd make a lot more money out of doing that, out of the contract for fixing the roof, than he would by stealing the roof. But that's honest graft. Honest graft meaning not breaking the law while engaged in corrupt activities. So, anyway, that's a longer question.
I might be the only one, but what's the Republican machine?
A fairly common pattern, less common now than it was 50 or 100 years ago, is a political organization in a city where you have, as it were, you've got a city boss, might be the mayor, he doesn't have to be the mayor, and then people under him and people under them, and they're all working together, and they've probably got a deal with the national party that, you know, do us the following favors, and we'll deliver you so much like a majority of votes in this city when you run somebody for president or senator or something. And the last famous big city machine, which may still, I don't know what it's still in operation, was the one I grew up in, namely Chicago under Mayor Daley. As you may know, Richard Daley ruled Chicago for, I don't know, 30 years or so. And when he died after an interregnum and several other people, his son took over. And I think, whatever he still is, but he wasn't for quite a while. And
Clinton's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, was not the mayor of Chicago.
That's right, you're right, of course, Rahm Emanuel now is and I don't know. He surely has ties to whatever is left of the old machine. And for that matter, our president was part of the Chicago machine. He got elected as a Democrat from Chicago at a point when. So, but it's really just a political organization, and such organizations are normally a part of a national party, although they're really semi-independent. Tammany was nominally Democratic, and I expect they delivered the vote for the Democratic presidential candidate in the 1890s or whatever, and apparently the Philadelphia machine was nominally Republican, and since Plunkett is Democratic, the Republicans were bad guys, basically. Anyway, the book I recommend to everybody, just for getting a feel for an odd bit of American history.
So are you tying that sort of to the feudal system?
The point what I'm arguing is that structurally it's a feudal system in the sense that I think it's really the district leaders and not the mayor who the people who deliver the votes owe their loyalty to. So in that sense, and I would argue that that's quite a common pattern in lots of human organizations, that you have a nominally centralized one. I was struck when I was reading stuff about the Abbasid Caliphate, the second, really last real dynasty in Islamic history. And there was a description, there were a couple of descriptions. One of them was Harun al-Rashid dies, and he has two sons who want to be a successor. And so he appoints one of them to be the next caliph and the other to be governor of the Eastern Provinces. And swears everybody in sight to keep the peace between them. It doesn't work, of course, and ends up with the civil war. And the comment by the modern historian I was reading was that it looked as though the older son, who was caliph, had all the advantages. And he sends an army off to fight his brother. But there was only one problem, and that was that the only competent general in the army he sent off was the one commanding it, because all the others refused to go. That doesn't sound like a centralized authority. And he loses that. Tom Mamun, who's the younger brother, wins and becomes caliph. And there was another bit, I think, in the same book where they're describing sequence where you've got some prominent local leader who is on the wrong side of some internal dispute, civil war, or whatever. So he's put under house arrest for 5 to 10 years. And then the Byzantines invade. And the caliph's army can't stop them. And so the caliph sends orders that this person is to be released from house arrest. And men flock to his banner. And he goes and defeats the Romans, that's the Byzantines who are invading. And again, that sounds to me like it's a real feudal system, where it's the local leader who can raise the troops. And if you don't need the troops, you can afford to lock up the local leader, or you do need a general who have to set free. And you see patterns sort of like that in the in English history, say, we have an explicitly feudal system, where when John needs help from William Marshall, suddenly John gives back all the hostages he's taken from William. So it's... Anyway, but the point I was going to make, sorry, which is we've gotten to a long digression, is that one prize, if you're the emperor of China, you know there have been periods when China had explicitly feudal systems. One of the things you have to be worried about is that it could break down from that. One of the ways you control that is to make sure your local officials don't have too much power. Because a local official, if you're the district magistrate and you're there for 25 years and you marry the daughter of the richest man in the province, and you've decided cases and accumulated obligations and done favors for people, there's going to be some point at which you're the real ruler in that province. So how do they control that? You're only allowed to be, I think, 3 years in one province. You're not allowed to marry anybody from the province. You have a team of your own subordinates who go with you, but then there's a permanent team of government-paid subordinates who stay behind for the next guy. So it looks to me as though a lot of those, but I suspect the appealing would be another part of that.
And you're not allowed to serve in the province.
That's right. You can't serve in your own province where you already have ties. And my guess is that a part of this whole network of how you maintain the centralized control is that important cases have to get taken upstairs for the final decision rather than the So there is an appeal system. The appeal system looks as though it's a very unusual and risky thing, that you can appeal a case, but did anybody get in a case involving the doctor who kills a patient and somebody else, someone involved, maybe I remember his son or husband or something, the person who's killed, insists on appealing the course of a case up to Peking? Well, basically,
see. I've probably got notes on. Let me see if I can find that. It's sort of an interesting one in a number of different ways. Basically, patient dies, and the close relative who is upset about it believes that the doctor has done something seriously wrong. The court dismisses the charges. The person appeals to Peking, and the court in Peking says, yes, indeed, the doctor did do something seriously wrong, and he will be sentenced to this punishment. And the punishment is then commuted for a small monetary offense. On the other hand, the guy who appealed exaggerated how badly wrong what was done, and so he gets a serious penalty, serious punishment. So it is not a case where appealing things to higher authority is a common or safe tactic, even though legally it is an option. And that was sort of a striking case where the person who is in some sense at fault is the one who gets off lightly, and the person who is pointed out the errors of the legal system gets punished for doing so. Other things in your cases that struck people that interested you? Anybody? Maybe we can go through that many fun and interesting cases, but how about killing your son? Are you allowed to kill your son? Under what circumstances? Under what circumstances can you or can't you kill your son? No. Not in general. You have to have an excuse. Basically, if you... Yeah, they've got to be sort of defying you in some sense. That intentionally and unreasonably killing this language and nothing wrong is a crime. You get 1 year penal servitude. So it's a fairly low end. If the son has violated the father's commands, the penalty is 100 blows heavy bamboo. If the son has reviled the father, or if the killing is accidental, or if it was just a reasonable beating that happened to result in killing the son, now there's no penalty. So there are clearly a fair range of circumstances in which the father can kill the son with no penalty. Yeah, so I'm told. I have not actually looked at that, but
doesn't appear to have ever actually been used. I can't cite any historical examples, but the claim was under the Roman law that the father had the life and death power over the members of the family.
Yeah, so they say. Of course, under Athenian custom, at least, exposing infants was perfectly legal, but I don't think that was true once they were older than that. There are a bunch of different things that are relevant to the question of relatives, of relations. To what extent did people pick up on the different sort of nuances of how somebody was related to you? Who couldn't you marry? All right, they have a very what is by our standards a very stringent incest restriction. Who can't you marry? Anybody notice? Any other member of your clan. And I think you can marry someone who has the same name as you, but I'm not even sure about that, because in general there's some tendency to assume that the same name implies some very distant relationship. So that, for example, if you have the same surname and you attack somebody who is senior to you by generations, not by age, the penalty goes up by 1 degree. All right? There's a general pattern. Did people notice, by the way, was the difference between being going up and going down? That is, the different patterns for those. Because this is one of the merciful things about the system, by their account, that raising, you've got, the way the punishments goes, you have a cluster of punishments. You've got exile to this distance, that distance, and that distance. You've got penal servitude, you've got military exile, you have strangulation or decapitation after strangulation or decapitation before. And the pattern is that when you bump a punishment up, you bump it up by one step within that system. So from exile to 1,000 li exile to 2,000 li or something like that. I don't remember the details. If you bump it down, you bump it down by a category. So from strangulation, from decapitation before the assizes to decapitation after the assizes, not to strangulation before, which is a huge difference, because strangulation before and decapitation before both kill you is just the one that messes up your body as well, whereas after, the odds are pretty good you don't get killed, though you might be. And so the general rule is that if you commit an offense against a senior relative, you get bumped up. Against a junior relative, you get bumped down. And apparently that applies even if the relative is such a distant relative as somebody who's got the same surname, but is not actually a part of the same family in any recognizable sense. And you have other cases. There's a couple of cases, I think page 385 to 9 is my note here, where you have an assault on an older relative by a younger under the orders of a still older. All right, so that it's something like one member of the family is trying to rape some other member of the family. A third member tells a younger member, stop him. And that results in a killing, perhaps an unintentional killing. And there are a number of cases of that general sort of framework. And the pattern seems to be that under some cases, the fact that you are under orders means you get a slightly lower penalty for the offense. On the other hand, if you are assaulting somebody who is senior to you, you as a result get a higher penalty. Leo?
So in Korea, related to families, the default assumption is if you have the same real last name, finally you can't marry. This was true up until the late 1980s when the Korean Constitutional Court said that law is no longer valid. It's no longer legal for you to marry someone who has the same final name as you. But up until recent history,
And how large a group was that? What fraction of the population had the same clan name?
Well, there were only like 26 last names in Korea.
I mean, everybody in Korea is called Kim, right?
Well, Kim, Park.
Yeah.
There are 26 common names for like 90% of the population. So it was a very small case in China. If you were the same last name from the same province, they have elaborate genealogies. There are still supposedly several quite a number of descendants of Confucius according to their genealogies.
So what are the incest rules now, if any?
In Korea?
Yeah.
I
think they
basically
adopted the United States, essentially. Which is it's what, first cousins cannot marry or can? Because that's something, of course, that's varied a lot. That is, as you may remember, the Athenian rule was that you could marry a half-sibling by the mother, but not by the father. There's one of the kinds of half-siblings you could marry, and the other kind you couldn't. Yeah, that's what I thought. So have you investigated for California and know who you've got to? You can't. So if you happen to find a first cousin you really like, the option is available. What? Do you have any data on that? Maybe, though, notice that there's a sense in which preventing those things results in more such genes in the future, because if you do put together two lethal recesses, you then take them out of the gene pool because the person who has them dies or can't reproduce. Where what? I see. Then that wouldn't be true. That's right. Yeah. Because, as you may know, there's an organized effort done, I think, by Orthodox Jews to prevent marriages of people of Tay-Sachs carriers. Some other things as well, but Tay-Sachs in particular. And it's quite interesting because what they do is basically they get people to be tested. When you are tested, you get a number to identify yourself. And it's not clear whether anybody has the records of the testing other than by number. And then when you are interested in a member of the opposite sex, probably not at the first date, but pretty early, at least if the Orthodox who believe in not very much dating before marriage, you then submit your two numbers to the people who have the database, and they come back with a yes or no to tell you whether or not you are both carriers, and that's all you know. I thought that the purpose of blood tests was for venereal disease. I'm not positive. I think what was going on traditionally was that you shouldn't get married if one of you was carrying a venereal disease because you would transmit it to the other. Or you couldn't get married till you were cured or something. I don't know the details, but I think that was what was going on with blood tests. Because I'm pretty sure that was before they knew enough about genetics to do anything very useful. Although, what about Rh positive? Isn't that... I thought Rh negative, Rh positive was something where fair while back they could predict the problem by blood tests. I'm not positive. You may want to check on that because I think that might be another thing that was going on at the time. The problem, I think, is in pregnancy, if I'm not mistaken. I think the problem is a clash between the blood type of the fetus and of the mother. Yeah, but I think it was the case that, and I think, though I'm not sure, that even before modern genetic testing, that was something they had a way of identifying, but I no longer remember the details of that. A bunch of other interesting things. Let me go back a minute on this question of when you can or can't kill somebody who's committing a crime. You will notice that at the moment, this is a very hot political issue in the U.S. because of this Florida case. All right, you have somebody who, by his version of it, essentially thought somebody else was, I'm not quite sure, I haven't followed enough detail, whether he was assaulting him or something, killed him. The claim is that the guy who was killed was entirely innocent. And different, sort of one of the controversies is under what circumstances. I mean, I gather that state laws vary in the U.S. In particular, when do you have a duty to retreat? And that I think in some states, you never have a duty to retreat in your own. Maybe everywhere you don't have a duty to retreat in your own house. I'm not sure. In your house. But you do have a duty to retreat in many states if you're not in your house. Is that right? I think that's right. Yep.
In Florida.
That's right. So in Florida, you don't. In Florida, if I see you as somebody who's attacking me, even if I could retreat, I think I'm allowed to use lethal force to defend myself instead of retreating. I think that's what the controversy in this case is over. If I fear for my life, right. And of course, the problem in this, and the problem in a lot of these, you can see in a lot of these cases, is in a sense a problem of evidence. That is that on the one hand, it seems reasonable enough that if someone is trying to kill me, take a case inside my house. All right, someone is trying to kill me inside my house, it seems reasonable enough I'm allowed to kill him. But of course, if I kill him, we're never going to hear his side of the story. All right?
Yeah, I was going to say that. It makes more sense just to kill them, because if you just shoot them, and yeah.
This is the advice I was given by a Philadelphia policeman. A long, long time ago, I was living in Philadelphia, and my then wife and I were witnesses to a shooting. And as a result, spent a certain amount of time in the courthouse sitting around chatting with policemen. I don't think I ever testified. I think she testified at some point. And a policeman I was talking with gave me some advice. And he gave me two pieces of advice. He says, if anybody breaks into your house and you shoot him, make sure he's dead. And the second piece of advice was, make sure his body ends up inside your house. All right. And I thought that was really interesting because it, like some other experiences I've had, suggested that policemen are no more believers in the law than other people, maybe even less. That he was giving what he saw as, you know, good advice. It wasn't being corrupt or anything, but the advice was to commit illegal acts, because the obvious implication was if the first bullet doesn't kill him, shoot him again. And the obvious implication was if he's running away and dies on your front steps, carry the body back inside, because you will be in legally better condition if you do that. And but that's sort of the problem through all of these things. So that you have the case where the father kills his son. How can you prove if the father says the son reviled me and the son did this and that? How are you going to prove he didn't? Now there is actually discussion of some of that issue in one of the cases, because there's a situation with which, if I remember correctly, I think it's somebody kills, it might have been his wife, but I'm not sure. And the claim is the person he killed had reviled his parents, if I remember correctly. And if that was true, it either eliminated the punishment or greatly reduced it. I'm not sure. I have to look at the case. But the question is it true? And apparently what the statute says is the parents have to have gone to the authority and complained about this person reviling them in order for it to count legally. It's not clear whether they have to do this in advance. It's not clear whether what's going on is that if they haven't complained before she gets killed, then it's assumed she didn't really do it, or if it's sufficient that after the son kills, I think it was his wife, but you know, it might have been his concubine or somebody else, someone in the family, that if the parents could then testify. But the particular case, I think the court was, either the court or the translator was objecting that it sounded as though they had accepted his word or the parents' word for the reviling without actually having checked that it had been reported to the authorities. Anyway, bunch of other interesting cases. There's one again, one of these interfamilial things is that somebody beats an elder relative of the fourth degree to death when the elder relative was trying to rape some other relative. He does it at his father's command. And the result of that is that his punishment is lowered from strangulation before to strangulation after the assizes. So in other words, without the father's command, he gets executed. With the father's command, beating somebody to death who's trying to commit a rape is still a very serious crime, but at a level just below the capital, or a level which could be capital, but isn't guaranteed to be capital, essentially. How about turning yourself in? Is there any, in American law, is there any, I commit a crime, it hasn't yet been detected, and I confess. Do I have any legal right to a lower sentence, or is it just that I have some hope that they'll be nicer to me? How about in Chinese law? What happens? What? There are two levels. If you turn it in yourself in before the crime is discovered, as long as the crime did not do irreparable bodily harm, you're home free, which seems surprising, but at least that's what the law seems to say. If the crime has been discovered but you haven't been caught, you get a 2-degree reduction in punishment, which is pretty substantial because each degree is a whole class of things. So it might take you down from one of the more serious exile things down to a beating or something. But this doesn't apply to irreparable bodily harm crimes. What is the category of doing someone irreparable bodily harm, which somebody has just been convicted of in the U.S., but theoretically doesn't exist in U.S. law? We just had a case of somebody getting 10 years, or at least I'm not sure what finally ended up, but I think it was supposed to be 10 years in prison for the crime of having a webcam on his camera on and seeing the beginning of a encounter between his roommate and his roommate's boyfriend, more or less. All right. Why did he get that punishment? Why, in fact, not in law? What was the critical factor that resulted in elevating what you would think of as a very minor offense to... That's right, the roommate killed himself. And as best I can tell, it's not at all clear that was the cause. That it seems to me, though I may be wrong, because I'm only getting this through news stories, that it was in fact a miscarriage of justice. But certainly what made it a big controversy at the beginning was the fact that the roommate killed himself. In Chinese law, on the other hand, that's really built into the system, that it's taken for granted that people often kill themselves. It's often someone else's fault. And doing something that causes somebody to kill himself is a really serious offense. So it looks as though if you're sort of weak and powerless and hopeless, and being pushed around by someone, you can get them into really serious trouble by killing yourself if you're willing to do it. All right? And there are a whole bunch of these cases.
so that, among other things, confessing to a crime doesn't do any good if you've done irreparable bodily harm, and somebody committing suicide counts as you or as somebody else having done irreparable bodily harm. Think about some of the other cases, because there are a bunch of other cases of the same general sort, where someone does something that results in someone else committing suicide, and it's the suicide that pushes it up into making it very serious. One thing I really ought to read you, because I assume you didn't all read, let me find it. Somewhere here there's a description of the career you people are planning to enter in. You're all going to be litigation sticks.